following on from the immense amount of responses we got when we had a conversation about NGOs and their influence in South Africa with NEDLAC, we thought that we're going to level this episode up by having a different member of the NEDLAC community. CEO of the NEDLAC Community Trust, Mr. Nhlanhla Ndlovu, joins us today to talk to us a little bit more around NEDLAC NGOs, the money in the sector, and what exactly it is that they're doing to change the lives of South Africans. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And to our guests at home, this conversation was such a big conversation that we thought that it is necessary to have a follow-up. We've had one of your colleagues on before, and today we've got the CEO of the Community Trust at NEDLAC, the National Economic Development and Labour Council, joining us, Mr. Nhlanhla Ndlovu. So thank you for your time. Because we had so many questions, we had so many follow-up stuff, and that's why we asked you to talk to us a little bit about your role and the Community Trust role within NEDLAC. First of all, explain that to us, and then we'll give you some of what the social media commentary sent us.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me here. Maybe just to start, it's a very difficult task, actually, like to explain, because there's a community constituency at NEDLAC. NEDLAC is created, I'm sure Thulani covered the fact that we are created by the NEDLAC Act, and we're a social partnership of government, business, labor, and community constituents. Now, NEDLAC, actually, the Act also created chambers. The chambers assist with dialogue on socioeconomic issues. So we only are represented on one of the four chambers, but that is to change because the NEDLAC Act is under review. So there will be a completely new NEDLAC Act soon, maybe like the process has begun where we have drafted the bill. But in terms of what the NEDLAC Act says is our responsibility.
You as the Community Trust, I think specifically what the Community Trust element of NEDLAC actually covers and means to ordinary South Africans.
We represent the voices of ordinary South Africans. But the way we are doing it, first, as I'm saying, the chamber that we are sitting in is a development chamber. Mm. In the development chamber, we are actually like putting on the agenda of the development chamber the issues that affect communities, any of the issues that affect communities that are either legislation or policy. With an intention of influencing either the parliament or influencing the cabinet in policy terms. So the parliament in lawmaking as well as policymaking by cabinet. Now, there are various areas which we have tackled over years. We have put issues of poverty on the agenda and all its dimensions. It could be hunger. It could be hunger in general in the population. It could be hunger for learners, for instance, when you are dealing with schools feeding schemes and such type of programs. It could be also about proposing ways of like fighting hunger. But there's other manifestations of poverty, homelessness. So we'll put those issues on the agenda of the platform that is responsible for policymaking. So homelessness, it has got to do with land, like for instance, influencing policies like the rapid release of well-positioned land in urban spaces and actually like influencing land in rural areas, including conversations over things like title deeds were advanced before the constitutional court clarified the issue of permission to occupy versus what you call title deeds. We had even like worked with our social partners at looking at what we call
I like the fact that, you know, one of the areas that you're picking up on specifically is around poverty and poverty alleviation. And in the time we are in South Africa now, the conversation is often around how much unemployment there is, which has an impact on poverty, and how particularly young people, how unemployment affects them so much. What are the things that NEDLAC and particularly the Community Trust constituency thereof, what are these policies that you are advancing and how do people get involved?
Okay, let's just look at poverty. So in 2018, we had a Job Summit Framework Agreement. Anybody can actually search online in the government, GCIS. There's a framework agreement on the Job Summit. So people could look at that. But in the job summit, what we did, in fact, we argued for expansion of existing programs and introduction of new ones, which was about targeting jobs. Of course, between like 2018 and 2020, when we had COVID, we then reviewed what we had achieved with the job summit. We had actually targeted to create 275,000 jobs in a year per annum. So 2 years later, instead of having upward of 600 jobs, we actually had created only 67,000 jobs. So we then had a process of creating the economic reconstruction and recovery plan, where there was actual targeting of young people, because this was during COVID in 2020 when the RRP was negotiated. Now, there's various things that we did. For instance, we had a focus in terms of education, skills development, or skills development in particular. The skills development, there is capacity building as well as training that is mostly focused in the industrial relations space, be it like government, be it private sector and labor. We then introduced a training for communities.
But what does this, you know, how do you respond to, but this sounds just like workshops and talking and meetings and doesn't translate into any tangible results for people.
No, it does.
How?
Okay, for instance, the states we are talking about, if you were to look at them, the youth, the unemployed youth, there is a category called needs or not in education, not in employment, education and training. You know, we have got 15 to 24-year-olds. They are the bulge in the unemployed. They are actually people who drop out of school, because if you are 15, you should be at school, if you started schooling at 7. Now, they are unemployed and unskilled. So when we are then doing these programs, when we are saying now we are going to have programs that target a young person who can bake and train them to bake, and then like they could be self-employed, because they do have self-initiatives. So when we actually give them the capacity to do that, to cook, whereas like the training for mechanical engineering could be targeting somebody with a matric and so on. Now we are actually providing portable skills where we are taking into account that these people have already been working in such spaces. So of course, you see, the problem is, oh, by the way, we also looked at mechanisms. There is a community education and training provision in South Africa that is not doing what it should be doing. With the RRP now, we have basically agreed that in all the 52 districts, that is the 8 metros and the other district, 44 districts, all of them must actually set up community education and training college, so that a young person doesn't know when they say their skills being provided, where do they go for that? Now they have got a place where they can walk in their own district. These places must respond to the broader provisions of skills in post-school education and training, but also look at demand for like quick bricklaying, whatever it is, quick skills, but also like look at comparative advantage. We have got master plans like your Oceans Economy Master Plan in South Africa that has got to do with the coast, but the youth in the coast, most of the time, have got nothing to do with the ocean's economy. They are mining areas where the mining sector is not providing adequate. So there's an element of making sure that the community education and training colleges are actually responding to localized needs.
So if there are these training centers, there is this response mechanism that you've been working on since 2018, and yet we still every day are reading about young people not being incorporated into any of these environments. Where is the gap?
The gap is
where the gap? Where are young people being lost in the gap, and how are you addressing that gap?
Well, there's various. Okay, the first gap is on implementation. Like every other policy, every other plan in South Africa has got a problem of implementation. So with us, what we've been doing, we've been advocating. So once we have advocated, it either becomes a right or it becomes a plan, whatever it is. But those plans, they also allocated money. But I can tell you for a fact that the things that have got to do with communities, that's where we underspend. Sitters, for instance, we've got 21 sitters. The sitters that are performing in response to the issues of our communities are those that basically reduce targets. So what they will do is that they were going to say we're going to have 5 rural programs. But when you're saying five, we are basically saying a project. So it's five projects in a country where villages are more than 1,000. So what then they do, target five and then fulfill the five and say we've completed our targets. The same with NPOs, they do the same. So part of the reason why they are doing that is because they were saying that there was no adequate response. And secondly, those who were responding, there was no compliance. So with us now, what we have done, we have moved beyond just advocating and like shaped ourselves in such a way that we'll then be able to implement now. So at national level, we are setting up mechanisms and partnerships for implementation on the community education and training element. All the stakeholders are already working together. Like NLC used to only build capacity for those that they've already that they are selecting to fund. But now we are saying
that's the National Lotteries Commission.
So they will fund, they will train those that they are preparing to fund. Now we're actually helping to institutionalize the capacity building that they are doing. The same with the National Development Agency that was mostly training capacity building for those that they are funding. Now we are actually putting those in the community education and training colleges together with the Department of Social Development that now we're in the second round between 2012 and 2025. We're in the second round of potential deregistrations of NPOs because of non-compliance. And there's if you look at a business, there's training on business law and all these compliances. With us now, we're making it, localizing it to a community to know that if you are running an NPO, these are compliances and stuff that you must have in place. This is what we must do every year. So we are basically bringing it near to the communities in that sense. But then there's also conversations we are having with the funders and the donors on how to improve. Because the truth is that the funding in South Africa is basically... it requires you to have an MBA in a sense to be able to access fund.
Mm.
The worst is the NPO Act. The NPO Act wants an NGO that is based in a village to have an audited financial statement by an auditor.
But here you on the one side you're saying we're working with the National Lotteries Commission, and on the other side you're also saying we're busy deregistering people for non-compliance. And speaking with the forked tongue, that also says if you are sitting in a rural community, you can't meet all of these requirements, which creates a space for well-funded, well-organized international NGOs to walk into the environment and be able to access all of the support from the NLC, support from even your organization, if you're saying these ones aren't compliant, but there are some that are compliant and we'd rather work with those ones. You're talking with the forked tongue because then you have created a space for international players to come into the backyard of people and give a service that you haven't provided.
Well, I mean, there's two parts to this.
Okay.
The international players are not given a space by us. The international players were present pre-democracy. And in fact, they've reduced if you were to look at the number of international players there are. So the international players always were present, but they always were resourced. So in fact, in a capitalist economy like ours, those who have got money, they will then have programs. They may even have programs that don't do much. International NGOs are building capacity that we don't know, how does it translate? Because they are not creating a dent on the poverty states. They are also not creating a dent on everything that we are basically, monitoring. So for sure, international, and then they are working with local NGOs. They are good in new things. Are you aware right now that a lot of the NGOs that are international, they are pursuing things that are not the daily lives of the people? For instance, in South Africa, we have got a very LGBTIQ-friendly law. But even in communities, people are not just being harassed because they are LGBTIQ. But there's a lot of money that has been pumped through the US agencies and other European agencies, which are about human rights for LGBTIQ, but not programs to improve their lives, just to basically look at human rights. So when you are saying we're speaking with folk time, we actually welcome, for instance, the presence of international NGOs. But we don't like the fact that they are bypassing actually national and other networks that could be helping them in designing the programs that are more meaningful, that have got more impact. So they're going straight to communities, and a whole lot of them, basically, they are driven by a need to prove that the meetings and workshops have happened. So it's about attendance registers. But at a second level, there's also like a real South African problem that we are addressing. The South African problem that we are addressing is that government, in fact, has been looking at civil society as a nuisance factor. And over years, the civil society resources have been caught up either in disdain by political leadership and the administrators in government, or some of them, basically, wherever there's money, they will create new NGOs and fund those NGOs. Whereas the NGOs that have been actually existing forever will never touch the money.
So how are you addressing this?
So what we are addressing is exactly that.
How?
The first thing I'm saying that, you see, the funding for NGOs have been made, or NPOs have been made, too onerous. And as I'm saying, compliance requires high top levels of skills. We are actually making this capacity to be accessible to localized NGOs and to know where they go. We do know that we're not going, if we forego compliance, we will be accused of sponsoring corruption. So instead of sponsoring, of saying compliance must go, we are saying, no, let them be compliance, but the person must have a fair chance of getting capacity to actually comply. And we are putting that in their district. Currently, these things are inconsistent. In Gauteng, you may have 1,000 NGOs that are dealing with capacity building. And in the Eastern Cape, in villages, there's zero. So we are now localizing and institutionalizing it. Secondly, even in terms of the distribution of funding, we have now basically begun to set up monitoring mechanisms. As Nedlac Community Trust, we are part of the structures that in this month are going to be launching the Civil Society South Africa. Under Civil Society South Africa, there's going to be increased compliance, and even ourselves, because government, we are saying government has taken on the responsibility, the very NPO directorate in DSD, or Department of Social Development, is an aberration, because we are being regulated by government, whereas we could be self-regulating. So part of what we are doing is starting the process towards self-regulations, and as well as monitoring ourselves. In that, we also have ideas of...
I need to understand it. Take it down a notch.
Yeah.
In the same way that you're saying, out there in rural areas and communities, the onerous compliance and regulations make it difficult for people to access some of what is available.
Yes.
I'm asking you to do the same for me and simplify what you're saying so that I understand it better. That says, on one hand, you are saying we're trying to make less steps, red tape.
Yes.
But at the same time, you're saying we want to regularize ourselves. We want to be the ones in charge of, and not DSD. What does that mean, though?
Well, it means, for instance, DSD, so if you are external to the environment, you may have your own intentions, for instance, of regulating things that should not be your priority in regulating.
External as in the government?
Government is external to civil society.
Okay.
So the onerous regulation is also, it has taken government 30 years because there's a review also of the NPO Act. It has taken them long to actually realize that we shouldn't be arguing for an auditor statement from a village. So if we are self-regulating, we're going to actually make sure that, in fact, there's certain things that we must forego so that there's ease of transferring money into people who are making a change on the ground.
But at the same time, just before I came into the session, I'm looking at an SIU report with regard to money that has been siphoned out of the National Lotteries Commission into registered NPOs who then don't do what they're supposed to do. So how then do you ensure that people are not starting NPOs simply to defraud the commission or to access money from potential donors for their own benefit, but rather for the community benefit, if you don't have this kind of standardized regulation?
So we don't have standardized regulation right now. We just don't.
Mm.
But also, you see, the National Lotteries Commission issue is an interesting one, because those are NGOs that may continue to exist and be able to siphon money out of institutions because they are sophisticated. So it's people who have jumped all the hoops, which are difficult in the case of a National Lotteries Commission. For instance, these are NGOs that already went there with 3 audited statements. They've got offices in all the metros and so on and so forth. So those are people that are receiving money currently. So you are not speaking for an ordinary organization that is still funded through the agents of the NLC. So what do we want to do now? Because you see, the point is, these national organizations, sophisticated organizations, whilst they are able to do compliance and so on and so forth, they are very poor at actually delivering. I'm not speaking for a whole lot of them are delivering wonderful programs. And they are compliant. It's not like in the NLC, everybody that receives money is corrupt. There are those that have actually extended their expertise and built all types of facilities in many communities. Now, what we are then saying is that, but there's then an organization in the community that is voluntary for the past 15 years, never receiving money except sponsorship, where they could go to Pick and Pay and then say, can we give us bread because we're running a feeding scheme? Then they get the bread, but they will never touch money. So what we are then saying is that we're reducing the requirements in line. I mean, the point is that we could have a full program on the actual measures that we are taking to reduce, and it's in consultation with the people on the ground. So we do need to have regulations, the regulations so that not everybody could basically receive money and do as they please. But at the same time, we are reducing they shouldn't be as onerous as to have the situation we've had, where for the past 8 years, most of the community-based organizations are telling you a story that they've never received any funding from anybody.
So how do you, at NEDLAC, ensure that this community trust that you have is represented by local voices as well as maybe international voices who have a stake in these communities, who are already operating in these communities, but that the sophisticated international voices do not drown out the local voices?
The network is made up of national networks. So the membership of the NEDLAC Community Trust is organizations like the Women's National Coalition, the South African Youth Council, the Disabled People South Africa. So they are umbrella networks. Theoretically, we thought, by not competing with them in delivery of their programs. So, for instance, there's a right. I'm going to make you a very clear right. There's a right in the disability space that employers must actually employ at least 2%. In their workforce, they must have 2% of people with disability. Since it became a right, it has never been fulfilled in most spaces. So as an apex, we don't necessarily didn't want to go to the disability sector and do on their behalf. We thought we would advocate, and then the organization relevant will pursue that. The same with youth rights. There's a lot of rights for youth. So what we are now doing, we are setting corporate services at NEDLAC Community Trust level, like capacity building. It's one of the corporate services. The funding, there's actually going to have, we are creating a civil society fund that will support these organizations, including the contributions from government and the private sector, to make sure that the monies go down. But we are also cascading the networks. So the networks exist nationally, mostly they exist provincially. We are now cascading them into like metro district level as well as community level. Because the problem is that when you are actually coordinating at a national and provincial level, you're creating bureaucracies. You are creating bureaucracies that could hold things from getting to communities. So we are actually creating, the civil society South Africa won't have these provincial structures. It will be actually having provincial and district offices that are reachable. And all their 5 priority programs, which is like capacity building, is transformation, is civil society fund, is self-regulation, as well as community development projects. So that's now where we will have presence without necessarily creating cumbersome bureaucracies. We'll have a presence in communities, accessibility by communities, but an ability also, because in terms of the social partnerships that we have established, we've got a relationship with government. We've got a relationship with the private sector. They are having resources that are not going where they are intended to go. So now with us having a presence, imagine if at a local municipality, which is in a village, then the structures exist that will be able to say to government, in fact, nationally, this is what we are doing with human settlements. This is what we are doing with just energy transition in the environment. This is what we are doing with water. But it's not us who have advocated policy. That has long been a policy and legislation. It's now the local program, I mean, local NGOs and civil society that is saying we want this to be translated into programs for the next, for the medium term, for 5 years. So then we are actually translating whatever it is that we've been having as rights into action.
Gajetni, someone is watching the show today and going, Labantu Laba, this has been, deadlock has been around since the dawn of our democracy. Why has it taken this long for you to recognize that there is a bottleneck in the system and suddenly you want to do so? Why has it taken you so long?
NEDLAC is a dialogue space for policy and legislation. So from its inception, we've advocated a lot and succeeded. But what we have done during that period, we've also left money on the table. The money that we argue for, that our people must get, it's money that is caught up in these billions. If we were to look in government department, there's things in every year that are about communities, but the communities are leaving money on the table. So we have then realized, that's why we are launching the Civil Society South Africa. We have realized, as I'm saying, that it's not enough to actually advocate and win if your victories are not translated into action. So now we are shaping ourselves in such a way that we are jacking up the ability to implement. And this is something that we are launching in June 2025, although NEDLAC has actually existed since 1996. So you see that out of the lessons, because, I mean, there's always a balancing act where you don't want as a national organization to advocate and then follow the man. It's like you're throwing a javelin, you're going to pick up the other side. So we had been set up in such a way that we are not implementers. And whilst we're advocating so that anybody in any corner of South Africa can go and claim the right. But it has not come to pass. We are saying we have got a gap here. We are fulfilling that gap now so that we see through, without competing with our members, we are seeing through the ability to advocate and get resources agreed on into the resources being put into programs and into our people not being arrested just because they all of a sudden received money, whereas they've been in 30 years in the sector and not getting money and not getting arrested. So all these things are the balancing act. It's very difficult to be a national organization, more especially if you're an apex of networks as well, because you don't have to step on other people's territory. Even now, it's them, as all these networks of civil society that say, no, we have to organize better. And we're agreeing, we're organizing better. But we're actually now becoming like 360 degrees. Whereas we were 180 before.
And how do people get to participate? How do people get to participate in the policy shaping and conversations? And how do people get to participate in this new, reformed, reshaped NEDLAC space that you are talking about?
There's various ways. We've always had participation. We're doing consultations. So first, I mean, organizations are, like as I'm saying, women, youth, and so on, they are organized on the ground. So they surface their issues, and we can't even complain about the fact that we've not been getting the voices in policy and legislation making. So that's not been our big problem. So we'll continue doing that, but we'll intensify. Because what then this enables is that a forum I'm from Umlazi, let me make my example as Umlazi. So a forum in Umlazi will then have a direct relationship with the Civil Society South Africa. But the forum of Umlazi will be having the streams of the different networks which are national. So youth will be youth, women will be women, environmental organizations, all these different sectoral organizations and networks will be organizing in Umlazi so that everything in Umlazi is taken care of. But then we are also directing resources at localized level, which we call the neighborhood, at district level, at provincial level and national level. We do emphasize now the thing that was never there with our thinking, the neighborhood. So having the neighborhood structures, and then sometimes what you do with the neighborhood structures is not to direct resources to them, is to build their capacity to design their own programs, to write their own proposals. Because remember, for instance, that there are programs that are being done by government and delivered by government, but with, like, in a clinic, primary health care programs are not delivered, although they are there in the national police. And if the government partners with NGOs, the reach is too far than what they are doing, maybe with tenders.
Well, you know, you speak about directing their own programs and coming up with their own programs and designing their own programs. And you spoke earlier about better resourced international NGOs who are able to do that much more, in a much more sophisticated manner. How then do you balance in this space the sophistication of the international guys who have their own view of how things can be implemented, things can be changed, which is not necessarily in line with local traditions and local activities? How do you balance those two things in terms of making sure that you don't have an overimposition of internationally benchmarked ways of doing things?
Yeah, well, I think there's a history of doing this, actually, prior, like, the civil society in South Africa had what it called, it had institute NGOs that were doing capacity building at local level. Now, there's two parts to it. We have got tools that are well established, and they come from South Africa that have spread throughout the world. For instance, of determining community needs, determining community assets, and designing programs that respond to communities in a way. South Africa has models where you could be having in a township section an NGO that has got people who are salaried, who are running the office, but the entire community volunteering in the program. So that's what we're reviving. We're reviving something that is already there. Now, the international NGOs have got also models that are very superior that come from elsewhere in the world. Like, there's something called, this is coming from India, which is called social auditing. The social auditing model is something that we will have to proselytize in South Africa, to spread in South Africa, because it empowers communities. So the balance that you strike is to make sure that, well, there's also a third element, the fact that a civil society space is so diverse. So you have to also allow diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So what then you do with the international organizations, you partner with them when they are bringing stuff that basically improve your practice and even improve your ideas. There's a lot of, for instance, in monitoring, the monitoring exercise localized can go a long way. There is a clinic where people just basically improved the queues. The neighborhood improves the queues by proposing to the clinic manager that, look, man, change the dates. You can't be having all these diabetes, all the chronic illnesses in one day, whereas we go Monday to Friday. And then they arrive, the clinic opens at 8, but they are queuing at
6.
Yeah. So the monitoring and evaluation told them that, in fact, by basically improving, spreading the chronic disease over 5 days, making sure that between 8 and 11 people are serviced, then you can continue with the clinic. So it's such things that it's people have got ideas. I mean, our people have got ideas. A grandmother who sits there and says, you know what, I end up like eating before I'm tested for my diabetes because I arrived there. I left home at 5 and now it's actually 12. I've not been attended and I'm like collapsing. So then there's various others, like improving the schools. You'll be shocked, in fact, that in South Africa, there's this trend, for instance, which is in social media, that is being identified. Sports fields, white elephants, they are actually getting dilapidated. And at the same time, we also want all these sports. So at localized level, you are not going to... The police is there to support amateur sports, to support... move amateur sports to high performance. There's various, everything, agriculture. I went to a Mzumbe Investment Summit and I asked the mayor, so where are you growing the beans, Mzumbe beans? Because it's a global brand, Mzumbe. Lo and behold, in Mzumbe, there's no Mzumbe beans. So what do you do then? I mean, when you're actually organizing, because we have advocated for seeds and seed, what you call these seed companies who are multiplying seeds. They are there. They want to actually do the Mzumbe bean. But if locally, there are no people who are saying, here's a bean that you must then replicate and then will grow. So it's a whole lot of intervention. So I'm saying that people then demand these things. You fight, you advocate for them. You win the advocacy. Then like a lacuna exists where nothing is happening. So this is what we are then doing. We were driving, cascading from national, working with international, looking at models. And in Africa, there's a lot of models. We were involved with the AGOA process. They even like villages that are complying with the AGOA like standards, which are very onerous. And in South Africa, because we have got a developed private sector, the most players in the AGOA space are the big business in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the entire continent, where AGOA is like 66 other countries, the 66 other programs in Africa that are in 20 countries, they are actually compliant outside of South Africa. Compliance is just achieved by very ordinary people. But in South Africa, we really believe that we can't, even like the cattle, you remember that in South Africa, whites arrived, the colonialists arrived and they were cattle. And everybody had like livestock. But all of a sudden, now we want to teach people now how to basically start a smaya because they've become so deprived. So it's stuff that we are reinventing, learning from also like some of the indigenous knowledge systems, but also like then like mixing it. It's like a mutual valorization of different civilizations. The international is bringing international standards. The national South African ones, we are basically cascading to the ground. The ground is implementing and feeding back to the system.
I like the explanation that you make. Oh, sorry. CS just needs to correct the mic positioning there for a second. But, you know, talking about how across the continent, they have been able to cascade this, all of these particular programs down to almost village level.
Yes.
And in your experience and in the work that you do, what do you think we can learn and what are the key differences between what South Africa does and how we do it versus the rest of the continent? How are they doing this better than us?
There's various mechanisms that they are using. For instance, I mean, there's NGOs that just know that we are the educated ones here, but we then have to service neighborhoods. Like it could be like the very same sophisticated NGOs we're talking about at NLC, National Lotteries Commission. So what they do in Africa, you'll find an NGO that is working on water. And that NGO goes, it doesn't need to have big, like South Africa, problems that the benchmark is there, most sophisticated. So they go to a village under the tree, speak about how to do a borehole, what becomes the responsibilities of the community. If there is farming, how to do the farming, how to manage their resources. So these are people who are actually orientated towards implementation. In South Africa, we have not done those models where you present in 10 villages because they are adjacent to each other. You're helping the communities. Mzumbe, I can go, actually, I can forego my position now and go to Mzumbe, which I know is a multi-million village with just the beans. Mm. So I could go to Mzumbe and go with the people that I already have in my networks who are doing soil analysis, who are doing everything that Mzumbe needs. But when they have like an intervention from a person who's able to pull different experts, who's able to speak their language and say, how do we plow? It's as simple as that. The problem with us as South Africans is that we have developed too sophisticated and complicated mechanisms and systems. All of a sudden, you get into the community, and when you are saying, you've got everything you need here, do. Then they say, okay, so where is the funding? Mm-hmm. When like it doesn't need the funding. Mm-hmm. So, and then the second point is that we may actually have to have successful programs to get some of the people who are stuck. The skills we need are stuck in private sector with no prospects of promotions and so on and so forth, but they could do a lot. I'm dead serious. Mm. I can tell you for a fact that there are people who are sitting with crazy skills. They've reached their ceiling. They are unmotivated, but the things they can do in communities. So part of it is then understanding our own value chains, understanding how to get, because the point is, all of us must orientate to get to the ground. So if you are getting to the ground and resourcing the process to get to the ground and then resourcing what is in the ground, because there's wealth in this. Like, I mean, how is it that the areas where there's most hunger is areas like where the biodiversity enables them to plow 10 different crops and is good for livestock. But those are the poorest places. And the reason why they are the poorest places sometimes is because they are left with grandmothers. There's no longer the abled youth that you said
are unemployed and sitting in the cities.
Actually, the 60%. So we actually have a 42% unemployment rate in expanded definition, 36% in the normal definition of unemployment. Of those, 66% is youth. And of those, more than 70% is between the ages of 15 and 24.
So we have not made it attractive to young people to be part of these kinds of solutions. Is that what you're saying?
We've not actually also created a culture of self-reliance. We've killed it. Because our grandparents were self-reliant. They never relied on the state. And so during democracy, we have like become so reliant on the state that we advocated for the SRD, the 350 now, which is 307. We advocated for it. We actually even were in a conversation 2 weeks with the Minister of Finance, ago.
The social relief.
The social relief of distress.
Distress grant.
But you see, there's other things. Like for example, the seed distribution. We argued in 2020 that it must be seed distribution and we know what grows where in South Africa. And then encourage people to farm, subsistence. So there could be aggregators who come in and say that because we have got a lot of surpluses, let's put them to market. But just to have food to eat in South Africa, we are not doing such programs. We're not driving. When I'm saying like do seed, we have got seeds, or which we could distribute, which are not genetically modified, which is, we don't like genetically modified organisms. Like organic and commercial grown seeds. We could basically plant the entire country and have food sovereignty, but also no hunger, zero hunger, which is a UN goal, a sustainable development goal. So all these things, the point is, when you are not doing, and when you are not careful what you are demanding, because our people are demanding a lot of things that are like just quick wins, maybe like return my electricity, return my water. But they are not demanding things like, don't give me a handout, like this handout, food and so on.
Food hampers.
Give me seeds. Give me something I'm going to grow myself. The other one is going to grow spinach. The other one is going to grow beans. It's going to grow millet in Limpopo. There's so much. Our people, they've given us proposals on these things. That's why now we are actually transitioning into supporting them. Because part of what we have seen at NEDLAC, maybe what I've not told to you, is that at NEDLAC, we actually take decisions that give private sector billions on the spot. They advocate there. Oh, so when you're saying there's a massive infrastructure program, who's implementing the infrastructure program? And why is it that big companies are like having a good time? But we're also advocating for our people on things that we can achieve. And then we achieve the agreements. They just don't translate into action.
And so now you're pivoting into that space.
I
would be very interested to see what that translates into, because I do think that, and we often have these kinds of conversations, and there's lots of, South Africa is very policy rich, and we struggle very much with implementation or translating it to results. That's why we sit with such high unemployment. We're not, so on the one hand, we could have take decisions that unlock billions, and yet we still, at the same time, complain about poverty and complain about, you know what I'm saying, and complain about unemployment. Yeah. So there is no balance between these two things. So I for one, am very much looking forward to seeing how this pivot will respond to the needs of the country. So thank you very much for coming in and having this conversation with us. Very elucidating. And good luck.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.